knew there had been much drinking last night, for there had been so much shouting, so much hooting and singing, and that was surely when the drawings had been made on the walls of the water closet.
So,
began Avdeyev, his voice all coy, obviously fishing for some kind of reaction to the drawing and the ditty. Any questions? Any problems?
Nits, Alexander Dmitrievich, respectfully replied the Tsar.
Avdeyev stared long and hard into Nikolai Alexandrovich's face. One of the guards across the room openly laughed, and Avdeyev's bloated lips swelled into a puffy purple smile.
Ничего?
Nothing?
Really? No questions of any sort?
I glanced over, saw the Tsar's face bloom crimson, noticed his chin begin to quiver. Was this it? Had the Tsar reached the end? Could he, would he burst with this last teeny bit of needling? And if so, if he fell, what did that mean for the rest of us? What hope would there be?
Nits.
Вопросов никаких.
No, there are no questions, tersely said the Tsar, holding his head as well as his voice steady, good soldier that he was.
Avdeyev shrugged and turned away, saying, Very well, then go ahead and have your morning tea.
Groaning and rubbing his head, the commandant lumbered off, making his way back to the main guard room on this level where, I imagine, he laid back down and went to sleep for a good long while. Meanwhile, Cook Kharitonov and I prepared the tea, which was served in the dining room. Black tea, black bread, and a bit of butter. They all sat down. The seven Romanovs, Dr. Botkin, and only reluctantly, only after all the others had taken their seats, Demidova and Trapp. Sure, Cook and I brought everything out to the table and sat down as well. That morning we were short just three things, two teaspoons and one butter knife, so the cutlery went around the table. But it went around in silence, for hardly a word was spoken during the meager repast. Immediately after breakfast, Nikolai Alexandrovich retired with his son to the drawing-room, where they sat with Dr. Botkin, who, though much improved, was still weak from his attack of the kidneys. In his beautiful voice, so clear, so resonant, the Tsar read aloud, as was his frequent custom, and that morning he read to his son and his friend Botkin the 12th volume of Saltykov, Pashechonskaya Starina, The Old Days of Pashechonye. And soon the work of Russia's richest satirical writer, this one, poking fun at the old landed gentry and bureaucrats alike, began to lift the morose cloud, filling the rooms of the Ipatkiv house with small but such significant peals of laughter.
And the women folk?
All morning they arranged things. Alexandra, her maid, and four daughters worked more furiously than ever, sewing secretively in near-constant shifts. I suppose, given the notes we had already received and the very real possibility that we might at any moment have to flee, it seemed the only wise course. So Alexandra disappeared into her bedroom, where, in the heat of the summer, she sewed away. A few minutes later, Olga Nikolaevna went to assist her, an hour later Demidova, and so on. Thus passed that painful morning, each of us, in our own way, trying to comprehend what lay ahead of us. Never, however, did I imagine so dark an event as would take place. Then again, such a thing is a chistka, a cleansing, a liquidation, was a new concept, one that would be played like a black refrain throughout the history of the Soviet Union.
10.
It was approaching the noon hour when a great Slava Bogu rose like a Gregorian chant. Yes, we all gave thanks to God when at midday Sister Antonina and Novice Marina came, bringing with them precious foodstuffs, including another priceless chetvert of milk. Cook Kharitonov and I were both in the kitchen when the visitors came, and again it was I, the kitchen boy, who received the goods from the sister.
Dobry dzień, my sons.
Good day, said Sister Antonina, her stout little figure draped in black as always.
Dobry dzień, sestra, I replied.
With pleasure and by the grace of God himself, she said, handing me a basket in which were nestled some eggs, we humbly offer a simple token. Kharitonov, who was boiling some water on the little oil stove, wiped his beaded brow and said, Ah, it is the good sisters of the world who keep our bellies full. Of course, our chickens are our pride, and we have such good cows, such fresh grass as well. The novice Marina here, Sister Antonina said, indicating her shy young apprentice, is a very able milkmaid. Isn't that right, Dragaya?
Marina was dressed not as rigorously in black, for I could see waves of rich brown hair beneath her headpiece, not to mention her ankles at the base of her black frock. And she just stood there, her head bowed, saying nothing. Instead, she merely blushed the color of a summer sunrise as she carefully placed a glass bottle of milk on the wooden table.
And today, continued Sister Antonina, we have not only more milk and such nice fresh eggs for the little one, but some cheese from our caverns as well.
They are greatly appreciated, I replied.
This I know. I studied the sister's apple-wrinkled face, which was so darkly and tightly swathed by the black wimple of her order, and saw that her cheeks and nose were red and swollen with the heat of the day. Tiny droplets of moisture glistened on the surface of what little of her skin was showing, and my eyes traveled to hers, linking us in silent communication. Her long gaze, punctuated by one double blink, telegraphed all that could not be said. Suddenly a guard appeared in the doorway, gun over his right shoulder, grenade on his belt. It was not the blonde guard, but the beardless one with dark hair.
It is not permitted to visit with the detainees,
he snapped, his voice surprisingly deep and gruff. Sister Antonina turned on him with a practiced and extraordinarily effective weapon of her own, a grandmotherly smile.
Of course, my son.
The commandant orders you to leave.
Da, 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 we were just going.
Now!
I understand, my son. Sister Antonina then leaned forward and kissed me on each cheek, whispering in the faintest of angel voices, Tell them to be ready as soon as tonight.
Yes, those were the very words she planted in my ear, which to this day have lived within my being like an earworm, a refrain that sings over and over and from which I cannot escape. The good sister followed after the lad, and I expected the novice to simply and silently patter after them both. Instead, however, novice Marina, her head slightly bowed, as always, stepped quickly toward me and, much to my surprise, reached to kiss me as well. Wondering what it meant, I stood there, quite surprised to feel her young, fresh lips upon first my one cheek, then the other. To further startle me, she reached for my hand and clasped her soft fingers around mine. Only in that moment did I understand the reasons for her affection, because in the slightest, most subtle of moves, she transferred a folded envelope from her palm to mine.
Do svidaniya, I muttered.
As she hurried off, I slipped my hand into my pants, depositing the folded envelope into the secret darkness of my pocket. Going about my business, I reached for the butter-yellow ceramic bowl in which cook always made the blini, the heir so dearly loved, and into this bowl, its glaze all crackled, I placed the brown eggs of the monastery chickens. I stacked them slowly, neatly, one fragile oval shell atop the other. Glancing first over my right, then my left shoulder, I discerned no guards in the corridor, nor any lurking in the dining room. My eyes met cook's, and he gave me a slow, knowing nod as he went about his business of preparing macaroni for Alexandra Fyodorovna. I asked, Will you prepare some of the eggs for Alexei Nikolaevich's midday meal?
I think certainly.
I lifted the glass bottle of milk, finding it indeed as fresh and warm as a newborn. I checked the doorways once again and pulled out the cork. As before,
There was a tiny slit cut into the stopper, and I quickly pulled out the small note that was hidden there. I started to...
Lomka!
Called a deep voice from the doorway. I jumped, nearly spilled the entire bottle of milk, and did in fact drop the cork to the floor. As quickly as I could, I crammed the note into my pocket.
Что?
What? I turned to see the Tsar's faithful footman, Trap, Alexei Yegorovich Trap, standing in the doorway. He was an old man by then, somewhere over 60, and had wiry gray hair and a healthy paunch. I think that he'd served not only during all of Tsar Nikolai's 23-year reign, but had also waited upon Nikolai's father, Tsar Alexander III. A life without a Tsar was simply impossible for Trap, who had gladly shared the royal family's year-and-a-half imprisonment.
Lyonka, began the manservant once again, if the nuns have brought more fresh milk, Yevgeny Sergeyevich requests that you be so kind as to bring him a glass to, soothe his stomach, of course.
Certainly. Trap withdrew himself, which went quite against the worn-out protocol of the imperial household. Then again, these were extraordinary times, and everything had changed. In previous times, however, a boy of my low status would never have been allowed to carry a mere glass or a simple plate to the dinner table or anywhere else within the royal apartments. Absolutely not. Back then, back in those days at Tsarskaya, everyone had a position and a purpose, and I would have remained entirely within the confines of the kitchen, which was in a separate building, and attached to the Alexander Palace only by tunnel. Any food that was brought to their highnesses or guests was done so by footmen like Trap, who usually transported any nourishment with great haste, running through the long tunnel and down the long straight halls of the palace. Upon entering the private rooms, however, one had to be quiet, for Alexandra Fyodorovna hated the clatter of dishes, not to mention kitchenly smells, the likes of which now perfumed our daily existence. But these were different days indeed, and I was no fool. It was my presence, not a glass of milk, that was requested. I took one of the thin glasses, poured some thick, rich milk, and then I recorked the glass bottle and glanced once at Cook, who nodded at me ever so slightly. I proceeded through the hallway where I slept, into the dining room where Anastasia Nikolaevna still sat with her drawing tablet. This was the route, this was my course. The youngest of the daughters looked up at me only briefly, her face blank. She was learning quickly the language of mistrust, of course, for there was a guard standing in the far corner, a tall fellow with dark hair and a huge bushy moustache, and so I continued to the other end of the dining room. To the left, and into the long drawing room. The three of them, Tsar, Tsarevich, and Doctor, were in the alcove at the far end. This was where Botkin slept, next to the large wooden desk in the alcove. He was reclined there, while the Tsar sat alongside in a comfortable wooden chair, and the heir remained in the wheeling chaise. Nikolai Alexandrovich continued the pretense of reading aloud, as I circled the large potted palm, but then he stopped as I delivered the glass to Botkin. The sestra has just brought milk from the monastery, Yevgeny Sergeyevich. It's still warm. She said it's fresh from the cow this morning.
Спасибо, молодой человек.
Thank you, young man, said the doctor, accepting the glass. I turned to the Tsar, hesitated. Nikolai Alexandrovich eyed the drawing room, then laid those magnificent eyes upon me. With a single nod, he bade me forward. I stabbed my hand into my pocket and snatched out the folded piece of paper and the envelope too. The paper was in the cork, I whispered, and the other, the envelope, was given me by Novice Marina. Nikolai Alexandrovich looked at them both, and spying the handwriting on the envelope, muttered with a smile, "Ah, a letter from Anya." He was referring, of course, to the Tsaritsa's only companion, her blindly faithful friend, Anna Virabova, the cow, as the Empress referred to her, whenever she was out of favor, which happened from time to time. But a loyal friend this Anya was. Persecuted, too. For the entire country thought she not only worked hand in hand with Rasputin, but that the Empress, the Mad Monk, and Anya herself formed a poisonous camarilla bent on the destruction of Holy Mother Russia. For this, Virobava was dragged from the Alexander Palace and thrown into one prison after another, from the pits of the fortress of Peter and Paul to Kronstadt itself. It was a miracle she survived at all. The starvation, the beatings, the filth, and the scourge. But she did survive. Somehow, she escaped an appointment with her own execution, went into hiding for several years, and then, eventually, fled across the ice floes to Finland, where she became a nun and lived all the way until 1964. And it is to Anna Virobova's credit that she was one of the few who worked secretly and continuously to save the imperial family, sending hundreds of thousands of rubles to secret agents in Siberia, who in the end did little but pocket the fortune. I leaned closer to the Tsar and quickly whispered, "Sister Antonina also said this," she said. "Tell them to be ready as soon as tonight." How do I describe Nikolai Alexandrovich's response? Was he stunned? Surprised? Excited? His eyes opened wider, remaining fixed on me as it sunk in, as he realized that their rescue could come as early as the day's end. All he said was a deep, single word. "Yasna. All is clear." I turned, retreating from the drawing room and my duties, and headed back into the kitchen, where I assisted Cook Kharitonov in the preparation of our simple meals. Lunch was soon served, servants and royals sharing the same table. And the third note, the one that I found, like its predecessors, in the cork of the bottle, it reads, "Do not worry about the 50 or so men who are in a little house across from your windows. They will not be dangerous when it comes time to act. Say something more precise about your commandant to make the beginning easier for us. It is impossible to tell you now if we can take all your people. We hope so. But in any case, they will not be with you after your departure from the house, except the doctor. Are taking steps for Dr. D. Hoping before Sunday to indicate the detailed plan of the operation. As of now, it is like this. Once the signal comes, you close and barricade with furniture the door that separates you from the guards, who will be blocked and terror-stricken inside the house. With a rope especially made for that purpose, you climb out through the window. We will be waiting for you at the bottom. The rest is not difficult. There are many means of transportation, and the hiding place is as good as ever. The big question is getting the little one down. Is it possible? Answer after thinking carefully. In any case, the father, the mother, and the son come down first. The girls, and then the doctor, follow them. Answer if this is possible, in your opinion, and whether you can make the appropriate rope, because to have the rope brought to you is very difficult at this time. An officer." This Dr. D, to whom they refer, that was Dr. Vladimir Nikolaevich Derevenko, who had been treating the heir. The Tsar often joked that their prison life was really more like one long trip across the ocean, each new day being identical to the previous. But not that one. A great stir in our routine had taken place, and after the midday meal, I heard many low voices and whispered discussions. Sure, they were trying to decide what to do, how to handle this, and what exactly it meant, this possibility of an imminent escape. At about 2, the entire household went down the 23 steps to take the fresh air. That is, we all went out with the exception of Dr. Botkin, Alexandra Fyodorovna, and her eldest daughter Olga, who remained with her mother to arrange medicines. And there, in the little garden, that scruffy yard, we were allowed to walk for 2 entire hours, on account of the stifling heat. Paced in circles, that was what we did, particularly the Tsar, who never stopped moving. Sometimes he appeared animated and excited, while sometimes he looked worried and anxious. I think he was pondering, trying to foresee the events of the next few hours and days. Though, who could have guessed what the Bolsheviki had in store? And the envelope that Novus Marina slipped from her palm to mine? Truth be told, I never saw its contents, and unfortunately the letter no longer remains, or at least it has not surfaced from the bowels of the Soviet archives. I imagine Alexandra ripped it up and flushed it, something along those lines, but it was most definitely from this Anna Virubova, the much assoiled friend. She was accused of many terrible things, but in the end of ends, she was merely a simple, exuberant soul devoted to her friends, the sovereigns, and their well-being. True, she must have been a natural schemer and an excellent one at that, otherwise, how did she do it? How did she get all those letters to the imperial ones and all that money to the secret agents? Actually, it has never been clarified. For writing from the safety of Finland in 1923, all that Mademoiselle Virubova confessed was, "Even now, and at this distance from Russia, I cannot divulge the names of those brave and devoted ones who smuggled the letters and parcels to and from the house, and got them to me, and to the small group of faithful men and women in St. Petersburg. The two chiefly concerned, a man and a woman, of course lived in constant peril of discovery and death. Though I was never to read the smuggled letter, I did see its effects, and exuberant effects they were. Gathered around the tea-table that afternoon, the Romanovs ate their slices of bread and drank their black tea, and surreptitiously passed the note from father to mother to daughter to sister, and so on, each of them not glancing at the words, but quickly holding the envelope to his or her nose and drinking in its scent. A marvel it was to them, something like a drug, something like a beacon that led back to the brightness of the dear past. I, who had driven the air in his chaise into the room, saw it all, saw their faces light up with shock and pleasure. "Here, Lunga," Alexei Nikolaevich whispered to me, handing me the envelope at the very end of the line. "Smell this." I held the paper to my nose, deeply inhaled, and my head bloomed like a flower. So rich, so sweet, that I couldn't help but sneeze like a horse. They all burst into laughter. Every member of the imperial family, and those few of us who were left of their 15,000 servants. "Budye zdorovy, Lyonka." "Be healthy," blessed Nikolai Alexandrovich. One by one, the others mumbled a similar blessing, while I wiped my nose and quickly handed back the note to Alexei, who tucked it hidden by his side there in the wheeling chair. Day passed into evening, and supper was served at 8. After the meal, the Tsar read aloud to Botkin, while Alexandra wrote furiously on a pad, and Tatiana, Olga, and Nyuta pretended to darn some undergarments, but really arranged. Eventually, too, Nikolai laid aside his book and took pen to paper, writing not his diary, but a note, or more specifically, a reply. "Da, da." The following day, when I carried out the reply to the third note, I also carried out two replies to Mademoiselle Virubova's letter. Sure, both the Tsar and Tsaritsa wrote back, notes that still exist, by the way. For rather than destroying them, this sentimental cow carried them all the way out of Russia, whereupon they eventually made their way to the preserves of Yale University in America. To his friend Anya, the Tsar wrote, "Thank you so much for your kind wishes, which we received only today. Our thoughts and prayers are always with you, poor suffering creature. Her Majesty read to us all your lines, horrid to think all you had to go through. We are all right here. It is quite quiet. pity we have not seen you in so very long. Kisses and blessings without end from your loving friend, N. Give my best love to your parents. The Tsar's reply, of course, took him some time to compose. Yes, he was the careful one. Everything in its place, including words on a page. The Empress, however, was all heart, all emotion. And her reply, written in English, came out in one long gush. My darling, my dear little owl, I kiss you tenderly. You are in all our hearts. We pray for you and often talk of you. In God's hands lie all things. We received your letter, and I thank you from my heart. It was such a joy to hear from you. One has so much to say that one ends by saying nothing. I am unaccustomed to writing anything of consequence, just short letters or cards, nothing of consequence. Your perfume on the note quite overcame us. It went the round of our tea table, and we all saw you quite clearly before us. I have none of my white rose to scent this. Thanks for your own. The children and father were so touched. They say that life in the Crimea is dreadful now. Still, Olga A. is happy with her little Tichon, whom she is nursing herself. They have no servants, so she and N.A. look after everything. D., we hear, has died of cancer. The needlework you sent me so long ago was the only token we have received from any of our friends. Where is poor Catherine? We suffer so for all, and we pray for all of you. I read much and live in the past, which is so full of rich memories. I have full trust in a brighter future. He will never forsake those who love and trust in his infinite mercy. And when we least expect it, he will send help and will save our unhappy country. Patience, faith, and truth. I won't speak of what you have gone through. Forget it, with the old name you have thrown away. Now live again. I am writing this in my bedroom. Jimmy is sleeping on my feet. Makes them hot. I keep myself occupied ceaselessly. I read good books a great deal, love the Bible, and from time to time read novels. I also sew, embroider, paint, with spectacles on, because my eyes have become too weak to do without them. I am so sad because they are allowed no walks except behind the house and behind a high fence. Father is simply marvelous. Such meekness while all the time suffering intensely for the country. A real marvel. The others are all good and brave and uncomplaining, and Alexei is an angel. Many things are very hard. Our hearts are ready to burst at times. The children are healthy. I am so contented with their souls. I hope God will bless my lessons with baby. The ground is rich, but is the seed ripe enough? I do try my utmost, for all my life lies in this. I am knitting stockings for the little one, like those I gave the wounded. Do you remember? I make everything now. Father's trousers are torn and darned. The girl's underlinen in rags. Dreadful, is it not? I have grown quite gray. Anastasia, to her despair, is now very fat, as Marie was, round and fat to the waist, with short legs. I do hope she will grow. Olga and Tatiana are both thin, but their hair grows beautifully. I feel utter trust and faith that all will be well, that this is the worst, and that soon the sun will be shining brightly. But oh, the victims, and the innocent blood yet to be shed. Oh, God save Russia! That is the cry of one soul morning, noon, and night. Only not that shameless peace. I feel so old, oh, so old, but I am still the mother of this country, and I suffer its pains as my own child's pains, and I love it in spite of all its sins and horrors. No one can tear a child from its mother's heart, and neither can you tear away one's country. Although Russia's black ingratitude to the emperor breaks my heart. Not that it is the whole country, though. God have mercy and save Russia. I find myself writing in English. I don't know why. Be sure to burn all these letters. It is better. I have kept nothing of the dear past. Just burn these letters, my love, as at any time your house may be searched again. We all kiss and bless you. May God sustain and keep you. My heart is full, but words are feeble things. Yours, A. P.S. I should like to send you a little food, some macaroni, for instance. Pathetic, is it not? A dethroned empress, herself a prisoner, wanting to send macaroni from Siberia. My eyes burst with pity even now. Odd this woman was, our Empress Alexandra, so complex. As I've said, her greatest crimes were both her pride and her insecurity, which caused her to hold herself aloof from everyone but her husband and children, while her greatest gift was her compassion. I find it strange that such wildly different aspects could live within one soul. But then again, a dog can be both black and white. I find it ironic as well that the Russian people of all classes merely wanted a tsaritsa of intense love and emotion, which was exactly their Tsaritsa Alexandra Fyodorovna. And yet, the more they disdained her, the more frightened and cold and distant she became. Why, such dark times were those. But, over the months of captivity I shared with them, these were the Romanovs I came to know, and, yes, the Romanovs I came to love. It was a captivity that grew more and more intense, from Tsarskaya Selo to Tobolsk, and finally Yekaterinburg. And it was really only toward the end that I developed the clearest of pictures of the imperial family. I do remember in Tobolsk when one of the Tsar's aides-de-camp, a certain General Tatishev, commented on the very same thing, how he was surprised to find the family so intimate and sweet on each other. And to this the Tsar replied with that gentle, ironic smile of his, "As my aide-de-camp over the years, you have had many such chances to observe us. Yet if you only now recognize us as we really are, how could we ever blame the newspapers for what they write of us?" 11. A summer night in Siberia only comes with great hesitation, and that late June day was no different, for the evening passed ever so slowly. There was a brief but heavy evening shower that rode across town, a gust of cool wind, and a clear dusk that never wanted to give up the day. That far north and that close to the summer solstice, it didn't fall dark until shortly after 11, yet the imperial family retired well before that, which was odd. Shortly after 9, the Heir Tsarevich was the first to bed, followed somewhat later by the girls. Often Nikolai would sit up reading in the drawing room, or Botkin and he would play draughts, the checkered black and red board opened upon the tea table, while Alexandra would sit at the nearby large desk laying patience, but not that night. By 10, they were making their way to bed. I was thus quietly instructed as well. All evening long, there had been much discussion to which I was not privy, but which I could imagine. Simply, was it possible that the rescue attempt would come as early as tonight? Yes. And on the sly, we were all advised to be ready to flee, for the Romanovs were determined not to abandon us, the last of their faithful. It was, of course, most gentlemanly, most old-worldly of Nikolai to decide on this course, but it certainly wasn't practical. 7 posed a cumbersome enough problem, let alone 12. Nevertheless, the decision came down the ranks, from Nikolai to Botkin to Trapp to Haritonov to me. "Sleep fully dressed," Cook whispered to me. "Be ready at any moment."
You mean I should wear everything to bed? I replied, as I made my bed in the small hall between the kitchen and the dining room. Everything. Even my shoes?
This threw him, and he thought for a long moment. Cook Kharitonov was a master at making a meal out of nothing. Wild mushrooms folded into a blanket of blini, leftover rice and cabbage tucked into the warm, doughy heart of pirogi. But a strategist of deceit, he was not. For a long, somber moment, he pondered my question before answering.
Niet, that would surely attract the guard's attention.
Then I'll just have them nearby.
Good, but if anything starts, we're supposed to run to their room and help barricade the door.
Sure.
The electric light was extinguished, and I settled into one of the most uncomfortable, anxious nights of my life. Sure, it had cooled somewhat, but I was completely clothed down to my socks. Within moments I was broiling. I started tossing and turning and grew all the hotter. I dared not cast aside my blanket, however, lest one of the guards make a sudden check. My mind began to spin, and so did Kharitonov's, I could tell, for on the other side of the tiny room, the large man tossed and rolled as much as I. So, how would it happen? Would a band of loyal Cossacks ride into town, whooping and hollering, screaming and shooting into the sky? Would monarchist officers appear out of the woodwork and slit the throats of the Red Guards one by one? I tried to imagine this scenario. If our secret rescuers would first take out the machine gun positioned on the roof, next storm the house, or if they would first attack the Popov house across the alleyway, killing all the reinforcements. Then again, maybe an airplane would appear out of nowhere, and the pilot would lean out, take careful aim, and let drop a bomb on the Popov house, blowing all the Bolsheviki to bits. A surprise from the air like that might be best, particularly since the house of special purpose had been rigged with an electric warning bell to summon all the guards. Whichever way it happened, I was sure there would be much blood, and I pictured myself the hero, leading the Grand Duchesses out the window and down a rope of bed linens. On the other hand, the window might be too dangerous, for it overlooked the side yard and the Popov house. So I might have to lead the girls down those 23 steps and to some waiting horses, or a motor vehicle of escape. I might even get a gun. I might even have to kill one of the Reds. And I imagine the Romanovs and me escaping with our lives. Perhaps I'd be wounded, but not terribly so, and then the Tsar would make me a count or a prince, or something, sure. All night I stirred with the possibilities. All night I imagined killing someone. And all night I heard the handful of guards posted in the cellar directly below, heard their shouts, their laughter, their drunken bouts. Each time I thought it was the beginning of the end, and my heart was fully roused, making it impossible to get any rest. None of us slept, or slept little. Once I heard a distant dog howl to the moon. Or was it a wolf who'd ventured as close as the city dam? Eventually, Kharitonov began to snore, and the guards below fell into complete silence, while outside the night slowly returned to the dead. I had no idea what time it was. Only the landed gentry and the aristocracy carried watches, but it must have been close to 2 or 3 before my eyes fell shut. While I later learned from a book that the Romanovs had all slept fully clothed and fully bejeweled that night, I have often wondered what they were thinking when darkness finally came. The girls, the boy, their parents, did they lie in their beds and pray for salvation? Did they smile at the thought of what might soon come their way? Did they weep with anxiety? I am sure that Alexandra, always plush with anxiety, spent the whole of the night worrying about her babies, her husband. If an escape attempt was made, would the guards pounce first and foremost on their hated Nikolashka, killing him dead? If the family fled in a mad rush, would the little one bump a knee or an arm, thereby plunging himself into nightmarish pain and even death? Playing through every scenario, from successful escape to hellish failure, the Empress recorded in her diary how sleep was not of interest. Colossal heat, though rained a little. I went early to bed, but slept only 3 hours, as they made so much noise outside. To this day, I imagine the Romanovs lying there sleepless as they drank in every step, cough, word, bark, and stir of wind. I'm quite sure they tossed all night long, wondering, hoping, fearing, and a horrible night it was, followed by a long, horrible, hot day, which was in turn followed by another terrible night of heated worry, for on the 27th she recorded, 8 o'clock, supper, 23 degrees in the room, scarcely slept. Perhaps it was Alexandra's bitter dealings with the aristocracy of St. Petersburg that made her paranoid. High society thought her much too prim, and constantly mocked her, but she was quite correct not to write all in her diary. In the old days, everything that could be used against her certainly had been. Consequently, she understood the dangers of writing a diary that was too specific. She had to be most careful, and for this reason it had become not so much a personal account, but a logbook of day-to-day events. Hence she recorded her work with her pounds and pounds of diamonds as arranged medicines, and her mention of scarcely sleeping, of so much noise outside, refers to those nights when we all waited for the rescue that did not come. At the same time, Nikolai Alexandrovich proved himself not as savvy as his wife. 27 June, Thursday. Our dear Maria turned 19 years old. The same tropical weather held, 26 degrees in the shade and 24 degrees in the rooms. One can hardly stand it. We spent an anxious night and sat up dressed. All this was because we had received 2 letters in the last few days, one after the other, in which we were told that we should get ready to be abducted by some sort of people loyal to us. The day is past and nothing happened, but the waiting and uncertainty were quite torturous. But why? Why in the name of God would he have recorded such things for the Bolsheviki to find and read? Was Nikolai Alexandrovich so naive? That's stupid? Or was he simply too much of a gentleman? Too much an aristocrat of the old world? Too much of a tsar to even imagine that such a personal intrusion and affront was even possible? So, there we were, the morning of the 27th. The day was sunny and hot, 22 degrees by early morning, but there was no summer brightness from any of us. Yet, we'd just woken from fitful dreams of hope, and were still groggy with disappointment. For better or worse, our emancipation had not been attempted during the depth of the night, and the waiting was, as Nikolai wrote, torturous. Whatever was to come, we all clearly understood it was the beginning of the end. Of course, Nikolai and Alexandra wanted their family to be rescued and carried to safety, but when they were faced with that very possibility, they realized how utterly foolish and dangerous such a rescue would be. And when it didn't take place in those first few days, Nikolai could see the darkness rumbling toward them, so much so that within a week or so he stopped writing his diary altogether, the very diary he'd faithfully written every day since boyhood. We gathered under a gloomy cloud for our morning inspection, and ate our bread and drank our morning tea with few words, but all of that was shoved aside for Maria's birthday celebration at 11. The Tsar insisted, for both as a good father and a good soldier,
He was concerned about the morale of his little troop. Seeing how heavy our hearts were, he recognized that our spirits needed attention. Hence he issued a decree, beckoning Ramanov and servant alike to wish the sovereign's number three daughter everything sweet and beautiful.
"A tea table in the late morning, how unusual," said Alexandra Fyodorovna, surveying the spread before her in the drawing-room.
"And why not?" pressed a beaming Maria, her eyes as big as saucers.
"That's right, why not?" seconded the Tsar. "After all, there's been a revolution."
"Oh, believe me, I know that." Alexandra shook her head in bemusement. "Just imagine. Everyone else used to have such interesting afternoon teas, but not us. We always had the same tea with the same breads, served on the same china, presented by the same footman, and it all happened precisely at the same time every day. Why, I don't think anything had changed since Catherine the Great."
"No, I think you're quite right, my dear," replied the Tsar. "The palace ran on tradition alone." Demidova, who stood next to me, volunteered,
"I quite remember, madame, when you tried to change a few things."
"I do, too, only too well, as a matter of fact. And wasn't that a disaster?"
"Wasn't it, though?"
Later that day, Demidova went on and on about all this, explaining that before the war, the Tsar's tea, like everything else, had been an amazingly regimented thing. The doors opened at 5. The Tsar came in, buttered a piece of bread, and drank 2 glasses of tea, not one more, not one less. On the other hand, Demidova had heard from other maids that the teas of the nobility had been infinitely more creative and extravagant, for it had been all the vogue to have a minimum of 6 different cakes at the tea table: chocolate, nut, berry, meringue, and so on. Now, looking down at the large, nut-shaped sweet bread on the table, the Empress smiled in delight and asked,
"Tell me, cook, where on earth did you get such a beautiful crendel? Did the good sisters bring it?"
"Nietz, madame, I made it."
"Really?
Look," exclaimed Anastasia, "it even has raisins."
Alexandra smiled.
"You're a magician, Vanya. How on earth did you make it in such a small kitchen, and how on earth did you come up with all the ingredients?"
Kharitonov humbly bowed his head and said, "Lonka and I, well, we make do. We make do."
The truth of the matter was that while we had scrounged up a few raisins over the past few weeks, the crendel was missing cardamom as well as candied orange peel, items that had vanished from the markets months ago. Nevertheless, the entire household recognized the creation as quite a feat, particularly because it was made of the precious white flour we'd brought from Tobolsk and had carefully hidden in trunks and walls and even the back of the piano, all this lest it fall into the hands of the guards. However, the recent spate of fresh eggs and milk, not to mention a bit of vanille secretly brought by Sister Antonina last week, was more than Kharitonov could creatively resist. For days he'd been looking for an excuse, finally seizing upon Maria's birthday. Making do without an oven, the master of improvisation had cooked the sweet bread atop the oil stove just this morning, baking it between 2 iron pans that he had carefully cupped together. Following the Tsar's lead, we rose to our feet, held hands, and bowed our heads as he intoned, "Gracious Lord, look down upon our dearest Maria with all of your infinite kindness and wisdom. We beseech thee to bestow upon Maria good health, long life, and great happiness."
"What about a husband, Papa?" interjected Anastasia. "She wants to get married, you know, and have scores of children."
"Anya, don't interrupt your father," chided her mother.
"But it's true, she wants to get—"
"Anya!"
Nikolai Alexandrovich crossed himself. "Hear our prayers, O Lord, and in these trying days, protect our cherished daughter. Amen." All of us, even the one guard who stood in the doorway, likewise followed the Tsar's example, crossing ourselves and muttering a solemn chorus of Amen. Nikolai embraced his daughter, wishing her birthday greetings, followed by Alexandra, who made the sign of the cross over Maria and kissed her as well. Usually, birthdays were observed at a luncheon with many distinguished guests, a lavish table of much food, entertainments, and great gifting for Russians are among the most generous sort, particularly when it comes to their children, whom they love to spoil and do so endlessly. In earlier times, a young girl of the nobility would be showered with sable hats and coats and muffs, pearl necklaces and diamond earrings, and so on and so forth. And even though such a celebration was impossible that summer day, hardly anyone seemed to notice. The Empress poured the tea by her own hand, an event once seen as a great compliment to a guest, but was now commonplace. Since the fine china was long gone, Alexandra filled tall, thin glasses perched in metal standards with handles. There was no lemon, no cream. The cunning Empress, however, had secretly managed to preserve a few cubes of sugar, and that morning we were all issued one. I followed Alexei's lead, pinching the cube between my front teeth as I sipped the tea, something that caught his mother's glare, to be sure, for it was a peasant's habit, something Alexei had seen one of the guards do. The krendel was cut and served, and then the gifting began. Olga presented a novel in French, Tatiana a bookmark that she had painted with her own hand, Alexei a rock he had polished like a sultan's jewel. A tablet of drawing papers came from Botkin, hand-knit stockings from Demidova, and a small bunch of flowers from Trapp. The baked delight, of course, was the gift from Cook and me. And after all of us had made our presentations came the finale, several packages from Maria's parents. "Here, my love," said Alexandra, "open this first." The young woman did, finding enclosed a religious title, Complete Yearly Cycle of Brief Homilies for Each Day of the Year. Maria opened the volume, silently cherished the inscription, and then read it aloud. "To our dear, darling daughter from your very own loving parents, Mama and Papa, 27 June, 1918. She folded the book shut and leaned forward and kissed her mother. "Спасибо, мама. Я очень тебя люблю." "Thank you, Mama. I love you very much."
"And what about me?" asked her father.
"Papa, of course," she said, jumping up and planting a kiss upon his bearded cheek. Nikolai embraced Maria, kissed her, and held forth a small box. "Here, my child, you must have something beautiful too, you know. Otherwise good fortune will not follow you in the year to come."
"Oi!"
It was this gift that Maria had been waiting all morning to receive, for she was not simply a Romanov, not simply a Grand Duchess, but most importantly, a young woman who was well-schooled enough to know how these things worked, that the prettiest gift always came last. And while what Maria found was no Romanov treasure, it was most certainly a thing of beauty, particularly during such dark days of imprisonment. The other daughters crowded around, and Maria lifted out a fine gold bracelet from which hung a simple charm of love carved from green stone.
"Ой, какая красота!"
"Oh, what beauty!" exclaimed Maria.
"Do you like it?" asked her father.
"I love it, and I shall never, ever take it off."
Maria jumped up and kissed first her father, then her mother, who fastened the bracelet on Maria's left wrist. We all finished our sweet treat and single glass of tea. Conversation dissipated, and we servants, knowing our places, retreated. Only Dr. Botkin remained with the family in the withdrawing room, and soon we heard the sounds of the piano. It was a little program, first featuring the voice of Anastasia as well as the Empress, whose contralto was so beautiful that she might have pursued a career in singing had she not been of such high estate. That was followed by the older pair, Olga and Tatiana, who played forehand a beautiful piece so sweet, so melodic, that it washed away any ill purpose from that house.
Hearing the flow of the keys, the gush of the tune, I froze in the kitchen, gazed out the window, and thought for a few brief moments that maybe everything would be fine. Da, even the guards momentarily lost their anger, their burning zeal, for I noticed a few of them pause in their random patrol and gaze off in uncomplicated thought. All at once, and only that once, did things within the House of Special Purpose seem at peace. But there were important duties to be done, namely, there were medicines to be dealt with, and looming in everyone's mind was the essence of time, as promising as it was threatening. In short, the celebration of Her Greatness Grand Duchess Maria Nikolaevna's 19th birthday soon concluded, and the feminine hands of the house resumed their deceitful needlework. By noon, the rooms took on the air of a sweatshop, albeit a secret one. Meanwhile, I wheeled about the heir Alexei, driving him from room to room. We played troika for hours, finding everything of interest when, in fact, there was nothing. Given our common age, we were able to see things others could not, however, and as such, the route around the dining room table became a troika track. The large potted palm in the drawing room became an oasis in the Sahara, and later the dogs, Jimmy and Joy, chasing and barking after us, were transformed into rabid wolves. Truth be told, we occupied ourselves for hours with a talent I have long since lost. During all of this, the Tsar negotiated a victory of sorts. Claiming that the hall where Kharitonov and I slept was insufferably hot, he successfully petitioned and received permission for the two of us to move to the other side of the house, to a room initially occupied by the Heir Tsarevich, who had since moved into his parents' room. While this small room was notably cooler than our little hallway, our comfort was not the Tsar's motive. "It won't do to have me and all the women on this side of the house," whispered Nikolai Alexandrovich with a wink, as we carted our few possessions to our new chamber. Sure, the Tsar needed all the muscle he could gather, and while I assumed that we were preparing for a fight or a battle, we were instead retreating. After lunch, the Tsar quietly pulled me aside. "Hide these envelopes as you did before, Maladoi Chelovek, young man," instructed the Tsar with a soft smile. "One is a reply. The other contains letters to be carried on to St. Petersburg. Deliver them as you did before, and you will have served us well." So, that was what I did. I hid the two envelopes in my undergarments, and when I went to the Soviet for more food from the cafeteria, I stopped briefly at the Church of the Ascension. Meanwhile, the Empress remained indoors with her oldest daughter, Olga, the two of them madly stitching their corsets, and the Tsar and others descended into the rear yard, where they paced in the tropical heat of the Siberian summer. And I went out, delivering the envelopes to Father Storozhev. One contained letters to their dear Anna Virubova, while the other contained a reply to the loyal officers, in which I much later learned the Tsar tried to call off the liberation attempt. "We do not want to, nor can we escape. We can only be carried off by force, just as it was force that was used to carry us from Tobolsk. Thus, do not count on any active help from us. The Commandant has many aides. They change often and have become worried. They guard our imprisonment and our lives conscientiously, and some are kind to us. We do not want them to suffer because of us, nor you for us. In the name of God, avoid bloodshed above all. Find out about them yourself. Coming down from the window without a ladder is completely impossible. Even once we are down, we are still in great danger because of the open window of the commandant's bedroom and the machine gun downstairs, where one enters from the inner courtyard. Give up, then, on the idea of carrying us off." This line was struck through. "If you watch us, you can always come save us in case of real and imminent danger. We are completely unaware of what is going on outside, for we receive no newspapers. Since we have been allowed to open the window, surveillance has increased, and we are forbidden even to stick our heads out at the risk of getting shot in the face.